From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're joined in the studio with singer-songwriter Lori McKenna. Lori McKenna has the life you probably don't, a husband, four young children, and a way up-and-coming career as a singer and songwriter with CDs on the rack and moving. But her lyrics go to the high and low moments of life we all know, love and doubt and mayonnaise jars with holes punched in the lid. Her sound has been said to blend the sincerity of Nancy Griffith, the heart of Lucinda Williams, the raw power of Alanis Morissette, and the clarity of Sinead O'Connor. Her latest CD is entitled Pieces of Me. Welcome, and awfully good to have you, Lori McKenna.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Hey, you're not blonde anymore. You're brunette. I'm looking at two CD covers. What's natural? Where's the real Lori McKenna?
I know. It's always changing.
Lori McKenna, you write music and sing it in a way that's so grown up, and I've jumped in talking about your four kids because it's not what we associate with singers and songwriters, and yet you embrace it and make it the heart of an awful lot of your music. We just heard a cut, Mars, from your latest CD, Pieces of Me. And what parent wouldn't know what this is all about? I mean, I just love you. You've got this country sound, but you're talking first about a hole wearing through this couch of mine. All the cushions are falling out, and then there's a hole wearing in your heart. How did you end up as a singer-songwriter with four kids at the same time?
At the same time? Well, it kind of did happen at the same time, as a matter of fact. You know, I always wrote songs to keep myself busy and to, you know, just that was my outlet, was always writing things down and playing my guitar since I was around 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. And I had my kids young, and I had no intention of ever leaving my house with my songs until I got to be around 27, and I decided that I would give it a shot. You know, I just, you know, it's kind of took that long to get to the point where I was comfortable leaving my kitchen and going out to open mics and things like that, and. It just took a life of its own, and has become an enormous part of my life now.
And people respond to it like crazy. Obviously, even though this is not teeny bopper love. This is a different realm of love, a different period.
Yeah.
The love that parents give to children. Do you find that? That you're alone in writing about that? Do you have many songwriters that you can reference who have so much of that, the issues of family and parenthood and sacrifice and hope, at the same time you're realizing your own limitations in their songs?
Well, I think that it's all about love. It's just like you say, it's maybe a different perspective of it. And I do meet people that have kids and do this, and, you know, it comes from the same place. But it's... I think that part of it is, you know, I got married when I was 19, so yeah. I had my kids really young, and I think that for most people nowadays, they experience the love life of a relationship a lot longer before they get to the kids.
And they experience it when they're in that young, passion-filled time of life.
Right, right. And I think that just for me, that all came. I met my husband in elementary school. You know, we went to school together.
You guys got going,
and you know, we got married really young. And so it's funny because in my life, I'm really slow at some things, and I do other things really productively. So,
well, you're a productive songwriter and you're a productive childbearer. I can't believe that you've got what your children are, but they're all in the young phase. They're all between pretty young and just entering teenage years. So
right. You're
really right in the thick of that.
Yeah.
This wonderful sense in your music of surrendering dreams and fighting surrender all at the same
definitely,
time.
Definitely. Because I think that's what it's all about, is picking and choosing, but not letting it go. You can't let it go, you know?
Yeah.
I really think that's important, and I don't think I could ever let my passions for certain things go, or I just wouldn't be the same person if I didn't have my guitar and didn't have this outlet that, you know, that I'm so lucky to have.
Mm-hmm. But you picked that guitar up and went to the open mic when there must have been plenty of Pampers all around the house. Where did you find the ambition, the clarity of purpose to stand up out of that and say, hey, I'm going to take this out to the open mic and get going?
Well, maybe that's what I needed in order to, you know, maybe I needed the kids to... you know, a lot of people, when they have young children, a lot of mothers, I've heard other mothers, you know, tell the story, is that you can lose yourself in that. And you can also lose yourself in music. And I think that I've, since I've been doing this, it's been about 5 years since I've been doing this out of my house, I've been trying to find the balance between both and, you know, not lose myself as a singer-songwriter and that's it, but also not lose myself as just a mother. I'm still Laurie, and I'm still a person, and I think that it's easy to get lost in motherhood, and You don't really find yourself until you're home alone again and the kids are in college. So I've kind of like just kept that in the back of my mind that I don't want to become somebody else for 18 years and then have to refine myself.
Yeah, here, who can't respond to that? We're talking with Lori McKenna, wonderful, up-and-coming and more than up-and-coming singer-songwriter. And I'm not sure quite how to characterize your sound, Lori McKenna. It's people say country, but then it's also got a pop edge to it. It's got a folk edge to it. How do you characterize it? Or do you care? Or is it only when they ask you where to put it in the record store?
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that question. I guess the easiest thing would be to say contemporary folk. I don't know where it is in the record store, to tell you the truth. I don't know I haven't checked each door to see where they're putting it, but I don't know what it's called, and I don't think it should be called anything, you know, specifically, and then because then you get into trouble, and you're trying to write for that one genre.
But we're going to talk about that, because genres do inform the way we hear music, the way we compose music, the way it plays in your own head, even before you've got the lyrics, and you clearly have got the great heritage of country music floating up there somewhere when you dive into your work.
I don't know where that comes from either, because I didn't grow up listening to country music. I grew up listening to James Taylor and, you know, Neil Young, but I didn't so much, you know, country music grow up listening. So it's funny.
Let's hear a little bit of your cut Fireflies from the CD Pieces of Me, Lori McKenna.
I slept in castles and fell in love because I was taught to dream. I found minutes, bottles, and boats holds on stop. Capture a tinkerbell, and they were just fireflies to the untrained eye, but I could always tell. 'Cause I believe in fairy tales and dreamers' dreams like bedsheet sails, and
Lori McKenna's Fireflies from her CD Pieces of Me. Lori, did you ever feel restricted in how you sang about it? Even here you're writing about I've slept in castles. It's kind of that in the wild time before responsibility came. Did you ever have any hesitation about making that the heart of your work? Did you say, think to yourself, I've got to write about wild love and fast cars and, you know, lines of cocaine, because that's what it's all about?
I think that a big part of it is like going back to that, the fact that I didn't leave my house with my songs until I was older. I think that was a big part of it, because I never had to write a song to please anybody but myself. And doing that for so many years at home, I learned to just, you know, to not try to format it in a way that I thought an audience would respond to it. And I'm just lucky that they
boy,
have.
Are we glad you did. Because the end result, like anything that's done purely, anything that's done really personally, ends up speaking to many people in a way that the mainstream just may not.
Yeah, we're lucky that that happens. But
we're lucky that it's happened with you. We're listening to Lori McKenna. This is Fireflies from her latest CD, Pieces of Me. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Caught frogs and called them prince and made myself a queen. And before you knew me, I traveled round the world. And I slept in castles and fell in love because I was taught to dream.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with singer-songwriter Lori McKenna. This is her song, Hardly Speaking a Word.
Well, I know your life has been hard. I see it in your eyes and I feel it in your heart. When your eyes move down to the floor and your mouth changes shape and your voice sounds sore, I can hold you close in my arms and tell you that you're special and that you treasure such great charms and that you always keep my heart. But I'm hardly speaking a word. I'm hardly speaking a word. And I know these things should be heard. But I'm hardly speaking a word. And you're struggle never changes me. I'll never be able to see the things you see. They say that you see things differently. And just because it's different doesn't mean it can't be.
Lori McKenna singing Hardly Speaking a Word from her first album, paper, Wings and Halo, which only came out a few years ago, Lori McKenna came into the world of singing and songwriting with four children in her world and a husband and a whole life, and you can hear it in every song she writes with incredible richness and sings about that love of children, about love of a man, and about a lot of other things as well we're going to be talking about this hour. Lori McKenna, I always want to ask songwriters about the issue of honesty. You know, it's hard enough to be honest when you're single and unencumbered, and you can say whatever you think about that man or woman last night, and you know, and maybe you'll never see them again. It's harder to be honest when you're in the web of relationships and commitments that a family represents. How do you deal with honesty, and how does your family deal with it in return?
Well, I think that I kind of feel like there's no point in spending the time to write the song unless you're going to be honest about it. It's kind of like writing in a journal. And if you're going to write a journal to yourself, there's no point in lying to yourself while you're doing so.
A lot of journals have a lock and key.
Yeah.
Your journal is pressed on CD.
Well,
and selling.
It's true. I think that you're right, but I think that I haven't really thought too much into that. I try not to. And the other thing is that my kids love it, and they don't read it. Sometimes I joke and say, you know, they're going to be in therapy about this someday.
No, you're probably working it out. You probably are the therapist.
Yeah. Well, this is my therapy in a way, and if it's something specific about my life, you can tell, but I think that you have to do it that way.
Do your kids or your husband ever come to you and say, Mom, honey, is that what you really feel after the CD comes out?
My husband's great about that. He understands that this is, you know, a piece of art that was created with all different things in mind, and maybe started specifically about something, but then can run in a million different directions from there. And he is fine. He completely understands that, and that's great. Like I said, I just don't see the point in doing it if you're trying to make everybody happy.
Hear, hear. What's the point? And when you tell that most honest, that most intimate thing, it's probably the thing that everybody will relate to anyway.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the song that I just played, Hardly Speaking a Word, I never thought in a million years that people would relate to that song, because that is one of my most... one of the songs that's closest to my heart as far as right from, you know, this perspective in my head. And I don't really explain what I'm talking about specifically, but you can't explain it too specifically, because then people won't take away what they need to take away from it. And the fact that people do that, and I was amazed at first that people, you know, all different people have come up to me and said, you know, that song reminds me of
this.
Thanks
for that one. But who wouldn't know that, since I'm yelling when I should be whispering? I should be saying, I love you.
Yeah.
How many times later in bed or later driving along we're rerunning the conversation and saying, why was I so, why did I go off the handle? Why was I such a jerk? Why didn't I tell them what I really
think? Or even if you have the opportunity to meet somebody that you'll probably never meet before, but you've appreciated in one way or another, like, you know, somebody that you knew about and then you got to an opportunity to meet and you didn't say, you know, geez, I really appreciate your work, or, and then you know, even that, like, just don't miss that opportunity, whatever it is.
Say it when it's right there.
Yeah, that's kind of...
Have you found that since you went to that open mic and you've been singing and writing more, has it translated into everyday honesty in your life? Or is this the outlet for that honesty you wish you had in your everyday life?
Well, that's true. It is definitely an outlet in certain ways. But I think as you get older, you become... You know, you try to become a person that's truthful in every aspect of your life, and that's something that I've tried to work on. Is, you know, I remember thinking of my grandmother, and as she got older, she was you know, becoming, you know, more and more expressive about her feelings in certain ways. And I think that if you don't bother to do that, sometimes you do have to work at it. You'll end up looking back in your life and saying, you know, I really wasn't honest with anybody, including myself.
So. It's all so much richer. You have put that honesty to work not just for issues of domestic love, though those are very powerful, but also for national issues. You've got a wonderful song, Ruby Shoes,
right.
Ruby Shoes, about Ruby Bridges, who Many Americans will know, even if they don't know,
know
her. Remind us who Ruby Bridges
was.
Well,
Ruby Bridges, she was. I mean, I think that people remember the little girl, and she was that little girl in the Norman Rockwell painting of the little black girl being escorted to school by the National Guard. And she was sent to an all-white school, I believe in 1964.
The height of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, and she was sent by herself to this all-white school, and she was sent there for first grade, and basically she spent first grade by herself, her and her teacher, because nobody else would send their kids to class that year. And the song came about from a book report that one of my kids was doing, a biography report on the story of Ruby Bridges. So this was the extra credit.
I'd say.
Ruby shoes would take her miles to school every day. Where the white people hated her, and they'd scream an old signs and tell her to go away. The bigots with signs could ever know. She stopped every morning on the counter and prayed that someday the pain would go, and she'd stop and she'd pray that all the hatred would go away. She was only 6 years old. Children wouldn't come. Well, they hated her for the color of her skin. Well, color is such an amazing illusion. She'd stop and she'd pray that all the hatred would go away. She was only 6 years old. That she wore. She wondered about us sometimes. Well, no other child ever walked her shoes before, and she'd stop and she'd pray that all the hatred would go away. She was only 6 years old.
Lori McKenna singing Ruby Shoes. taking us back to a moment in the civil rights movement that we've all seen in Norman Rockwell's painting of little Ruby Bridges mm-hmm. going to school, young black girl,
yep.
6 years old to an all-white girl school. 6 years old, Lerma, can I know that you lost your mother? She died
mm-hmm.
when you were six.
Right, yeah.
A number that comes up in that song. How does that loss play out in your voice as a mother, in your voice as a singer?
Well, it's kind of like one of those things that, like the children and like the family, is this big part of me, and I think that in a way that instilled my belief to, like you said earlier, not let go of those certain dreams mm-hmm. and things that you have to, you know, hold on to and keep you sane or mm-hmm. or insane, whichever works. But I don't know. I'm kind of, you know, my husband always says I'm in my own world, and I kind of am in a lot of ways. But I think that it just affected me, obviously as a child, and it just comes out in me every day. I find little pieces of it in songs that have nothing to do with it. And sometimes I look back on things like the song Fireflies that you played earlier. Mm-hmm. And I look back on it, and there's a line that says, "Before I grew up, I saw you on a cloud." And that's mm-hmm. kind of like, you know, a piece of it that...
Sounds like mom.
Yeah, I think it kept like this dreamer in me. Mm-hmm. Instead of inhibiting that, it just kind of brought it out more.
An attachment to something that wasn't right there.
Yeah, because I had to like believe that she was somewhere watching over me. Mm-hmm. And I still, to this day, can show argument to that fact, that I still believe, you know, mm-hmm. I still believe that somebody told me, in explaining what happened, somebody said, you know, your mom's an angel now. And, you know, angels mm-hmm. pop up all over the place in my songs too. But I think it's just, you know, that piece of me that I grew up with that, you know, you can't just, like, pack up somewhere. It just comes out.
Still the energy.
Yeah.
It's still there. Laurie McKenna, we're here in the background here, Pieces of Me. Now, there's a love song and a grown-up love song.
Yeah.
I love this very grown-up awareness of the texture of love that's in so much of your work.
Yeah.
This isn't child's love. This is real.
No, this is just, that you don't know where it's coming from, but it's just one of those things that just comes right out, and it's on the paper, and that's how it stays.
Let's listen. Pieces of Me from Lori McKenna. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
That's you. Close to me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're with singer-songwriter Lori McKenna. This is her new song, Beautiful Man.
Well, I should have told you I sold my soul to an angel. I should have this world is not my own. I should have wrapped you like a present. I should have gotten to you before you were grown. Beautiful man. difficult. I should have shown you the scars of my soul. I should have told you I wanted you to take care of me without allowing you to gain any of my control.
Lori McKenna singing Beautiful Man, a song so new you can't buy it anywhere, but you're hearing it here on Point. Lori McKenna, it's so good to have you. You're singing Beautiful Man, and I'm thinking, beautiful woman. The way that in this song and so many of your songs, this isn't cutesy or beseeching or hiding in mascara. You're really telling it straight from a woman's point of view. That's the way it sounds anyway. Have we come to that point? Do you really feel free to write as a woman, unfettered, honestly about your view?
Yeah, I mean, I really don't. I don't feel like I have to worry about it. And, you know, like we keep talking about, it, really, what's the point if you're not going to be honest with, you know, whatever that emotion is.
You're so there. Larry McKenna, you know, it sort of looks like you've got it all. You did the kids early, now you got the career that's budding so beautifully. Does it feel that way to you? I know from the outside, everybody wishes they had the kids, they had their career started, and then everybody wants to be an artist one way or another. You've got it going. Is that how it feels on the inside of Lori McKenna?
Well, I keep teasing that I'm going to write a book someday.
That too? Jeez.
No. It's just, I'm just one of the luckiest people you'll ever meet in your life, and everything has, you know, maybe it's because I'm just trying to do what works for me, but it all has worked out perfectly, and I'm at this point now where, you know, the balancing act between the kids and the music has really is really working out, and I'm just incredibly, incredibly lucky.
Wow, Lori McKenna, there's so much we haven't even got to. Pink Sweater, everybody's got to hear that someday. Mm-hmm. Your homage to James Byrd, who was dragged behind the pickup truck and died in Texas, and a gutsy song. And the last song on your album, Pieces of Me, You Are Love. Tell us about it.
Well, that's a love song of letting go. It doesn't really matter which kind of letting go, but you know, I'm gonna let you go. But I wish you, you know, all the happiness that you deserve. You know, that could be, you know, a child growing up or a relationship that just doesn't work anymore.
It sure could. Let's listen to a little bit.
I need no
You Are Loved from Lauren McKenna. Lauren McKenna, we thank you so much for coming in. It's just been great. I hope you'll come again.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Ah, you're an inspiration to us all. Keep writing, keep singing.
Thank you so much.
And lucky children, lucky husband, lucky us to hear you, to have you. You can learn more about Lauren McKenna on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org or check out Lori's site, lorimckenna.com. Up next, a look back at this week's news. This is On Point.
Better day. The wings of your skin fly away. Sometime when my smile can say all the heart needs say.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, here are some sounds from the week.
Here's a man who knows about additional terror attacks. Here's a man who trained people to do this.
We are just now inside the church without any protection, just the protection of God.
Afghanistan's interim leader, Hamid Karzai, appears to have escaped an assassination plot hatched by a hardline Islamic group headed by renegade warlord Gulbuddin Hekmatyar.
Private grief and public pageantry. His pain clearly etched on his face. Prince Charles remained tight-lipped as he followed the coffin of his grandmother from St. James's Palace to the ancient medieval hall of Westminster.
From one Navy base in Cuba to another Navy base in Norfolk, Virginia, Yasser Isam Hamdi will remain there until officials can determine if he is a U.S. citizen.
The world finds itself at a critical moment. This is a conflict that can widen or an opportunity we can seize. And so I've decided to send Secretary of State Powell.
They can't get together without an external force bringing them together. And I think we've got to deepen that process. It's one of the things, obviously, I will discuss with the President over the course of the next few days.
There's a week whose beginning seems a long way away. Donald Rumsfeld on a top Al-Qaeda member turned over by Pakistani police, a Palestinian Christian trapped in the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, Hamid Karzai's government surviving a coup attempt. Britain mourned the Queen Mother. The Al-Qaeda in Guantanamo turned out to be an American citizen. Bush on the war in the Middle East, and then Tony Blair, who, of course, is now in Crawford, Texas. Jack Beatty, a long week that the Middle East, that Israel, that Palestinians and the West Bank just erupted to completely overtake.
It did, and to completely overtake the White House, which has changed course dramatically, and much to the president's credit. I mean, we hire presidents to manage reality, not to be ideologically or doctrinally consistent. And the president had to bow to the fact that our allies in the Middle East, upon whom he counts in the war on terror, were saying, you have to be more involved in trying to work out this impossible situation between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And he did. He, for a year and a half, he resisted it, and he changed. Would that Lyndon Johnson had been able to do that
in the Vietnam era. But I'm thinking, Jack, that you talk about managing reality or dealing with reality. I have a feeling that we're not finished yet in the contest over defining reality, about what's really going on here, about whether the right response to terror is to crush them, to talk with guns, or to talk with tongues, to negotiate.
I think you're right, and I think that that impulse is in both the – it's almost sort of embodied in the State Department and the Defense Department. In the Defense Department, it's clear that the idea of imposing a structure on reality, this is the way things will be, is the dominant note. And in the State Department, which actually has to talk to foreign governments, they're all about adapting to the war on terror, figuring out how to go about it. And the president is in the middle, and I think he made the right choice this week. And we have to face up to it. I mean, the choice he made to involve his prestige, the government's prestige in this, may well lead to the committal of American troops in the Middle East for a long, long time to come, both as peacemakers and peacekeepers and even peacemakers, because it's impossible to imagine these two people living together now.
So you're thinking U.S. troops, somehow their bodies in between Israelis and Palestinians.
Yeah, the Tom Friedman, Anthony Lewis call for a long time, and I think that they were right when they said it months ago, and they're still right. I mean, how could the Israelis ever trust that a Palestinian government wouldn't loose terror bombers on it again? It's just not possible.
But a lot of Americans may still be having a hard time getting their heads around the idea of that kind of long-term commitment. On the other hand, we heard on the show this week John Mearsheimer square off with Victor Davis Hanson. Victor Davis Hanson saying the only solution is steel, is guns, is show 'em force. John Mearsheimer saying we can't win this just by force. If we don't get troops in there or somehow get the Israelis and Palestinians apart, Mearsheimer is saying you're going to have terrorism going on for most of a century.
I think that's right. And so that's those are the scales. I mean, on the one hand, the committal of American troops, which could mean, 100,000 troops, who knows how many, and who knows for how long, and with an almost certainty of violence and death among them. That on the one hand versus, on the other hand, the scenario you just gave of an endless terror bombers, first against the Israelis, but eventually and soon against us.
But where's the country on this, Jack?
I don't know, and I think the president is going to have to step up and talk to the people about what the choices are. I had a moment listening. I spent a couple of hours listening to talk radio, AM talk radio this week, and I was frightened by what I heard. Two shows, both with some national base, and full of the vilest hatred toward Arabs. I heard the word shiftless, lazy, they've done nothing in 1,000 years. It made me fear that if there is another terrorist attack in this country, Arab Americans could be in real trouble. These were hate mongers, and all they were talking about was you've got to crush these people, contributed nothing to history, on and on and on. And this is going across the airwaves all over the country, this right-wing radio, and it's scary.
President Bush did seem to lay down his own marker, though, in that debate this week, and maybe one that steps away from that view.
I think he did, and I think that he's, he has been sobered by, among other things, the rise in oil prices, the demonstrations in the capitals of Arab states that are allied to us, and of course, both those phenomena would occur if there were war on Iraq.
Well, Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us. I guess there's a lot more coming to terms with reality one way or another coming up.
I think so, and it's bound to be painful.
Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, and to our listeners.
On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Laura Tanguso and Isabella Tabarovsky. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.